am an alcoholic, and thank you, Billy, very much. Thank you for asking me to speak. It's always an honor and a pleasure to do service in AA. And my sobriety date is June 20, 2003, and as you said, Midtown is my home group. I live in Falls Church, Virginia, and I have a sponsor, and I'm sponsored today. And those things are very important to me, and they are the foundation of my sobriety. And I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'm trying to think. I had my first drink when I was 6 years old. It may have even been earlier than that. I grew up in an alcoholic household, and my parents had parties. I mean, it was just a big party house, and they were very social, and every weekend, you know, either my parents were going somewhere or they were having people over. And when I was six, I was visiting my friend Justin, and we were playing around the house, and we had colds, and his mom was going to go out, and so she gave us a little cough medicine, and she followed that up with a little mint schnapps, because cough medicine tasted disgusting, and I think she was hoping we would go to sleep, like, oh, this will be a great thing, they'll go right to sleep. Well, Justin and I both have similar reactions to alcohol, and we did not go to sleep. We ran around the house, and we were terrors, and that day we got into, you know, his sister's makeup and put makeup all over us, and I cut my hair, I cut my bangs, and Justin actually broke his arm that day. He was racing his brother and tripped on a pipe and broke his arm, and he always got nosebleeds, and I lived right down the street from Justin, and I called my mom that day, like, could you pick me up? And she was like, why don't you just walk home? But she noticed something in my voice, so she came and got me. And I didn't tell her what had happened that day, and she didn't notice that I cut my hair for about a week. So that kind of tells you, like, my household was a little crazy. There was a little bit of stuff going on. Because it wasn't just a little bit. You know, it was my bangs. I'd cut them off. So she was trying to do my hair, I think, the following weekend, and was like, what happened? And then, you know, I had my first grounding, and so that's what happens to me, you know, when I let go with alcohol. And, you know, growing up in an alcoholic household certainly does not make me an alcoholic in any way, shape, or form. In fact, what I really think it did is I think that it protected me for many years for drinking the way I wanted to drink. You know, I was a daddy's girl, and I was a daddy's girl until I discovered that my dad was not fully present, you know, and we would, you know, spend evenings together, and he would make promises, and the next day, you know, I'd be like, well, aren't we going here? And he's like, you know, having no memory of what the promise was or where he thought we were going. And we had planned this whole trip to Florida one time, and my brothers and I were all ready to go, and my dad had no idea that we had actually planned this trip. And so, you know, my brothers and I are talking about this for weeks, and finally my dad's like, wait, what are you talking about? So he had to quickly make up for that, and we did go to Florida, but only because, you know, it was like, oh, shoot, what are we doing? You know, starting at the age of six, I certainly did not become a daily drinker from there. That was, you know, I don't think I drank again until I was probably 13 or so. However, when I was at about eight, I went to a wedding, and I was drinking ginger ale, and I was trying to convince all the other kids that I was drinking champagne. And I don't think that's normal for kids, you know. I don't think it's normal to try and tell people around you that you've been drinking, you know, like, why is, but I really thought that made me an adult. I thought that was, like, the proper thing to do, and that was what was going to fix everything. And I knew that from a very early age. I grew up in a very small town. I don't know if it's very small, but it was about 5,000 people in New England, and it was very, you know, it was very much about status and about society. And that's, my parents ran in this circle of friends that, you know, they're either socializing here or socializing there. And when I was about fourth grade, my parents separated. And this was a big, you know, this is a big to-do. In a small town, everybody knows what's going on. You know, everybody's talking about this. And it was very interesting to watch. And I was really fortunate that a lot of the parents, that my parents lost all their friends. I mean, because nobody wanted to take sides and nobody wanted to, and it was just a messy, horrific time. So but luckily some parents kind of took me in and rounded me up, and we were like, all right, we're just going to take Lindsay with us wherever we go. And I was really lucky about that but then as years went by, it was interesting because the relationships that my parents had had with all of, you know, the town was just sort of gone. And so, you know, starting in about seventh grade, I would go to a friend's house, and I was just kind of always looking for alcohol. You know, I don't know why, but it was like I was on the hunt, and I knew that's what I needed. And I remember, you know, having a sleepover at a friend's house, and they had some non-alcoholic beer, and I was like drinking that, thinking at least it's something, you know. And you know, and then switching a non-alcoholic beer for one of the parents' beers in the fridge, thinking, like, well, they'll never really notice the difference. And, you know, I have no idea what happened. But I didn't experience a lot of consequences growing up all the way through high school. You know, I ended up going to a private day school, and, you know, like, we were kind of, the day school had students from all over the state of Connecticut, and the state of Connecticut's not that big. If you drive from north to south, you could cover it in an hour and a half, and from east to west, you can cover it in about 2.5 hours. So it's not very big. But so we had everyone from all over the state, and they would have parties on the weekends, and everyone would just stay at whatever house they were at, and that was like the known thing to do. So it was sort of just acceptable. And my mom, I remember my mom fighting this. I was in seventh grade, and I'm like, I'm going here. Eighth grade. And I had taken a small bottle of ginger ale, and I poured out the ginger ale, and I filled it with vodka. And not knowing that there was going to be alcohol there, but just knowing that I was going to need alcohol. Like, don't know what's going to happen, but better be prepared, because this sounds like what everybody else is going to be doing, so I better have mine. And that was kind of a standard. It became a standard anyway. And so I went to this party, and it was a cast party. You know, you have play, and after the play, they have a big party. And I remember I got there. I drank the entire small ginger ale bottle of vodka, and was great for about half an hour. And then I was so dizzy and sick that I sat against a wall and just sat there for the entire night, like pretty much the entire night until I got sick. And then I was able to function a little bit more and, you know, going about my ways. But I didn't really talk to anybody about this. I just knew that, like, this is what I needed. This is how I was going to be okay that night. And, you know, in high school, a lot of my friends were having consequences. My friend Catherine, that I ran with a lot, she was getting in trouble all the time. And she was great to run with because she would get in trouble, and I'd be like, oh, no, I wasn't there. Or, oh, yeah, we weren't doing that. And I'm not sure. You know, I just felt like, I'm so much better than you. Like, I don't get in trouble. You know, and I had this, when I cut my hair when I was six, I'd been grounded for a weekend, and my mom was like, if only you were honest with me, it's going to be, you know, it'll be okay. So I would give her, you know, about 70% truth. And 70% truth was like, I'm going to tell you enough of the story. Like, yes, there was drinking at this party. I drank a little, not too much. You know, meanwhile, I'm like the go-getter, you know. But I got away with everything because of that. And she knew. You know, like, there's been alcoholism in my family for, you know, generations upon generations, and there is not a lot of recovery. In fact, as far as I know, I'm the only person in recovery in my family today. But she knew, you know, that this was going to be a problem, and she was like, well, I'll buy you alcohol if you stay here, or if you promise me you're not going to go there. And so that's what I did, you know. And when my parents divorce, we would have parties at our house, and we would have people over, and there would be alcohol. I mean, it was just kind of standard. That was the way it was. And I remember it was my senior year of high school, and there was the school that I went to. My graduating class was 40 students, so it was pretty small. And it was 7 through 12, and there were about 250 students total. And the teachers at my school had kind of caught on that the Frost House was the party house. That was where everybody went. And we had this meeting about there was going to be a cast party again, and we had this meeting with everyone in the cast, and we said, okay, here's the deal. Everybody knows in the school that our house is a party house, and we're gonna have a party, but we're not gonna have alcohol there. And my brother was really pissed because he'd started this business with selling alcohol. He was making a profit on all the alcohol that we had going. My mom, when I was a sophomore in high school, had started traveling to D.C. for work, and so she would be gone during the week and would come home on the weekends, and we would have parties on the weekends. And her deal was like, stay here. I'll supply it, whatever. And she had her own sickness, of course. So we told all the students we were not gonna drink. And my brother was a little upset by this, but he was like, "Yeah, I'm sure we'll use the alcohol for some other event. Not a big deal." And I remember getting to my house that night, and it was a Saturday night. And I remember walking around, and everyone was having fun. And someone set off fireworks in our backyard, and so the police came. And the police came, and they said, you know, and they wanted to search the house, and we're like, that's fine, you can search the house, nobody's drinking. And it was just this kind of weird scene, because it was the one time we weren't drinking, and the police showed up, and it wasn't this so cool that, you know, it was like, oh, we got away with it again. But the police left, and all I wanted to do was drink. And I remember just having that feeling like, I have to do this now. I can't do this. And so I changed the rule. I said, everyone at the party can't drink except for the seniors, and all the seniors can drink. So we brought all the alcohol into my room, and everyone was running in and out of my room that night. And, you know, and I drank to oblivion because I couldn't handle it. I could not stand being in my own skin sober. And I could not have told you that at the time. I did say clearly that night, though, like, I know I said I wasn't going to drink, but all I want to do is drink tonight. And it was kind of like, you know, maybe that could have been a sign, but I certainly wasn't. I was like, you know, we're here to have fun, and this is how I'm going to have fun. And so I graduated high school, and I went off to college. And the first college I went to was in College of Charleston. And, you know, I was in a kind of weird place. Like, I felt like my home was this, you know, like, I felt like my house in Connecticut was my only steadfast, like, it was the only solid thing in my life. You know, like, my family's dispersed and everything's gone, falling apart or whatever, but... And 3 weeks before I left for college, my mom told me she was moving down to D.C. because she couldn't bother traveling. And, you know, my selfishness is like, no, you know, don't do this. And I got a little depressed, and just a little, really. It was bad, actually. I went to college, and I was terrified. And I was terrified to be around, you know, the College of Charleston is about 10,000 students, and that's double the size of my town on a campus, and it's in the middle of a city, and I was just like, this is crazy, I don't know if you're a student, I don't know if you live in the town, and I just realized, like, I can't drink the way I want to drink around all of these people, because I don't know what's going to happen. So I tried to control my drinking. And I did not know that that's what I was doing. All I knew was that I was, like, miserable and unhappy. And after a semester, I ended up going home and moving to Virginia. And I lived here, or I lived in Northern Virginia for about a year and sort of got myself back on my feet. And in that period of time, I had surgery. I had appendicitis. I had... I was depressed that, you know, I took a semester off, and then instead of going back to school, I was like, oh, I'm not ready to go back to school. How about I go to Costa Rica, and I'll learn, you know, I'm going to learn to speak Spanish. I'll teach you all English, and, I'll teach students English, and I'll just live there for a couple months, get myself back together, then I'll go back to school. And I was in Costa Rica for a total of, 3.5 weeks, and I got sick, I had surgery, and I came home, and someone suggested to me that smoking pot would relieve pain. And I was like, oh, that sounds like a great idea. So I started smoking pot. And I mean, alcohol is for sure. I am an alcoholic. There are a lot of drugs in my story. I would call myself a table user. If it was there, I was going to use it, you know, like really. And I didn't know, you know, I wouldn't have thought that. You know, I was a big, DARE advocate growing up when I was in sixth grade. I signed the papers, really convinced that I wasn't going to do drugs or, you know, and that's just not the case. If you put something in front of me and I'm feeling uncomfortable, I'm going to take it. Or if I want to have fun or think this is going to make the night better. But anyway, so I started smoking pot, and pretty much from then until I got sober, I smoked pot every day. I mean, it was just, I enjoyed it. I thought it was great. And now I was probably 19, and I got sober when I was 24. So, a good 5 or 6 years of pretty regular drugs. But anyway, I spent a year. So I was living in Northern Virginia, and I took a couple classes, and I decided I wanted to go back to school, so I was taking classes at Nova, and then I thought, well, I need to move to California, because California is where I'm going to really show everybody that I'm an independent person, and my people are in California, that's what I thought. And so so I went out and I looked at a bunch of schools in California, and I had this idea that I wanted to get into speech-language pathology, and so I went out there and I looked at a bunch of schools, and I ended up in Sacramento, and I was supposed to wait to go in the spring semester. I applied for fall, but the plan was to defer a semester so that I would save money and get all my stuff together. And I did stuff like this a lot. Like when I went to Costa Rica, the plan was that I would go in 4 months. And then I applied and I got really excited and I was like, no, I need to go in 3 weeks. And that's what I would do. It became like, I have to do this now. And it was really because I was so uncomfortable in how I was living. And I felt like if I went there, that would be a solution. So I was supposed to go in the spring. I got in, I got accepted for the fall, and I was like, I gotta go. And, you know, my parents are amazing. They're so supportive. And so my mom and my stepfather, they took out a loan. They're like, all right, let's go, you know. Maybe this will help me. And my mom felt, you know, I did a good job of making my mom feel really guilty for things that happened in life that was absolutely out of her control. And since then, you know, I've had to make some amends for that, but I'll talk about that in a little bit. But so anyway, I go to California, and they put me in a freshman dorm, and that October I turned 21. And I was like a goddess in a freshman dorm, really. I mean, it was like we had this deal, you know, I'll buy you alcohol if you give me a portion of the alcohol. And so there was this trade-off, and it was great. I was buying alcohol for lots of freshmen and having a great time. And, you know, a couple weeks being in school, I defended this girl who was a lesbian, and someone was making fun of her, and I was like, don't make fun of Erin, you know, maybe I'm a lesbian, and I've never been a lesbian, but, so anyway, I just like to open my mouth and say crazy things, so, it was the night before my first paper is due at school for the fall semester, and these girls on my freshman dorm room come in, and they sit down, and these three girls, and they sit down and talk to me, and they say, Lindsay, we need to talk about this, and we're really concerned. Like, if you're, you know, if you're interested in girls, that's fine, but we need to set up a shower schedule. And I was appalled, you know, and I was like, well, A, I'm not going to tell you if I'm a lesbian or not because it's none of your business, and B, I was just defending this girl, and I don't really care. But it became this huge to-do, and I got really upset. And because I'm a people pleaser, and I want everybody to like me, and suddenly, like, all these girls are in my dorm, or I felt accosted, and, you know, whatever. So I made it this big dramatic scene and called my friends and thus missed my first exam. So I don't remember. I think it was an exam, not a paper. I'm not sure. But so long story short, that semester I ended up with a 0-0, and I felt like I had full justification. And so I came home at Christmas, and I was like, wow, that's really too bad, but, you know, and I sat down with my parents, and I was like, look, this is the first time I've ever gotten to really be a kid. I was just playing, you know, I just had a semester of fun, it's not going to happen again, and I believed this. I really thought, like, I'm going to turn it around, we're going to start over, you'll see, and I really thought, like, I'm going to go back. And meanwhile, my brother, he was the one person who really gave me a hard time. He was I have twin younger brothers, and I used to party with them a lot, and I thought they were just like me, and one of them might be, but the other one definitely isn't. And Brad, the one who definitely isn't, likes to drink and is a great drinker, but he does not, I mean, he's got a plan for everything. And he's got a backup plan for everything. And he follows through with them, you know, like, always. It's amazing to me. I'm just blown away every time. I mean, I call him, and I'm like, so what do you think about this? And he'll actually send me down paths that would have never have occurred to me. But anyway, he gave me a really hard time for coming home at Christmas, like, with a 0-0. And he's like, what are you doing? And he was still in high school at the time, and I was like, you don't know. You don't understand. Forget it. And so I go back to school, and I'm like, ready, I'm going to pull myself back together. And, you know, that first semester I had gotten into some other kind of crazy drugs. And, you know, I did a semester of ecstasy. And then I was like, that's how I was. I was like, well, we'll try this. Well, this didn't fix me, and that's going to cause a lot more trouble, and that's probably going to kill me. So let's move on. And meanwhile, like, alcohol is really, like, the mainstay throughout everything. And so I was in California for 4 years, and I kind of was in and out of school, and I guess it was, you know, and a lot happened in that time. I spent a lot of time talking to police officers. I never actually had any trouble. Like, I would get pulled over, and some friends of mine and I went to the middle of nowhere. I'm not sure. We saw a lake on a map, and we're like, let's go. So we went, and we were looking for a pretty place to, you know, to go get high and have some fun. So we went, and this police officer drove by, and we were in my car, and we get in my car, and, you know, the police officer pulls me over for driving too slow, and he followed me for 5 miles because I was waiting to find a speed limit sign. But anyway, he pulls me over for driving too slow, and I talked to him, and you know, got away with it. And that's the thing, is I got away with a lot. And I'm so fortunate to not have caused real, like, physical harm to so many, because I definitely was not, I spent a lot of time driving and was not sober. And I didn't drink and drive, actually. I was like, I'm not drinking. And I had friends who died drinking and driving, so I had a big, huge fear around this. But, I mean, the truth was, is at the end, I was drinking and driving, because there was no way. I mean, though I hadn't drunk before I got in the car, it was like the night before, I was still drunk the next morning. There's absolutely no way that I was sober. So anyway, I've been in California for about 3.5 years, and I was about to be on, I was continually on academic probation, but just enough to stay, just ahead of the game enough to still stay in school. And I was not going to make it that semester. And so it was summer, and it was about July, and I started to panic, and because I was going to be kicked out of school, and I'd already reinstated myself once, and meanwhile not telling my parents that 70% truth to my mother, well, being 3,000 miles away, it gets easier to tell her less. And you know, my family, my parents are sending me money so that I can survive, and I'm telling them, like, it's really expensive to live in California. And so they're sending me money, and it's awful. It was awful. I got myself into a lot of debt, and my mom finally said, like, you have to get a job. This is ridiculous. Like, I can't afford to pay for this. And so I'd gotten this job, and I was working at a coffee shop, and there was a guy there who would come, and he would did the laundry. And someone mentioned to me somewhere along the way that he was in AA. And so I was at a friend of mine's house, and I had fallen through a wall. It was like one of those long days, and I hadn't eaten anything, and I didn't go to school, and I, you know, was a little drunk, and then did like a 4-footer, and literally fell through a wall, and I was unconscious for over a minute, and I woke up to my friend Trina on the phone with 911, and she said, no, we don't need an ambulance, we just need to know what to do. And so they're telling her, I can hear them yelling across the phone, like, you need an ambulance. We are going to send an ambulance. And I'm yelling, no, I'm okay. Like, I can't open my eyes, but I'm okay, really, I'm okay. And my friends made me go to the emergency room. So I go to the emergency room, and the doctor in the emergency room looked at me and wrote on my orders, eat regular meals and don't smoke pot. And why I was honest with that guy that day, I don't know. But I was. And Trina, the one who had called 911, the week prior or something, had gone to her cousin's rehab and had been in a meeting for, like, the family meeting. And she came and talked to me, and she wanted to know if there were any alcoholics in my life. And I laughed. I was like, of course there are alcoholics in my life. I mean, come on, are you kidding? And she looked at me a little scared, and she said, well, I went to this rehab, and they had told me that, you know, alcoholism runs in families, and she said, and alcoholics all kind of run together. And her mom apparently was like this heroin addict who had gotten off heroin and was on meth and finally gotten off meth and wanted to go to AA and get sober because she was still drinking. And Trina wanted to help her, so she was like, would you be willing to go to an AA meeting with me? And I was like, yeah, in fact, I know someone in AA. I'll ask him where the meetings are. So I go to work, and I ask Ben, I was like, you know, I have a friend whose mom, and he really thought this was funny, but I have a friend whose mom is interested in AA, and I was thinking we would go and check it out. Do you know where a good AA meeting is? And he was like, Lindsay, it's in the phone book. Go find it. And I was like, wow, that was not very friendly of him. What does he mean? So anyway, I pursued this. I kind of liked this guy, so I pursued this again. And I was like, Ben, no, really, the next day, I need to know where a good AA meeting is. I mean, I know where I can look this up, and I'm sure there are a lot of meetings in all of Sacramento, but where, you know, but if you go to meetings, there's got to be some good ones. And he was like, all right, Lindsay, he's like, what's the deal? And he's like, you get messed up every day, don't you? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, don't you think that's a problem? Now, this is like a couple weeks after I started having my panic attacks. And I was like, yeah, I think I have a problem. There's something wrong here. But this isn't for me. This is for my friend's mom. And he's like, well, he said, "Do you want to go to a meeting?" I said, "Yeah, I'll go check one out for a friend." But then he wasn't interested in talking about her. He wanted to talk about me. And so we started talking about me, and I was like, no, AA is not for me. Like, I had, when I was 16, I went to an AA meeting, and I remember sitting in the meeting. We went to an Al-Anon meeting, and then after the Al-Anon meeting was the AA meeting. And we sat in both meetings. In the Al-Anon meeting, they recommended we stay for the AA meeting. And so we did that. And we read from the big book. And I remember reading about God, and I was like, nope, not doing it. Because when I was a kid, when my grandfather passed away, my family was not religious. We didn't go to church. It wasn't something that was big. But when I was a kid, I absolutely believed that there was something greater than me. I believed to my innermost self that there was a God out there. But when my grandfather was sick, my mom said, "Pray for your grandfather. He's sick." And then he died. And I was like, well, that didn't work. You know, like, what am I, you know. And then through a series of circumstances, like, I kind of shut God off. And I really thought, I'm not important enough for God. I prayed. It didn't work. What am I, you know, he's not paying any attention to me. So I would do things like, I would pray to my grandfather. And I figured, I'm just talking to him. But, so anyway, Ben started talking to me, or I started talking to Ben, and we talked about a lot of different things, and he had me read some interesting literature that has nothing to do with AA, but talked about love and how that, like, there is something inside of us that we are all connected, and that there, you know, that we do have a giving connection through everyone. And anyway, so I read some stuff, and I really thought I was really attracted to this guy, and it turned out, like, I was attracted to his program, because after I got sober, I was like, wow, you're just not the same person. I mean, there was just no physical attraction there, but I followed him around, and we talked for 30 days. And after about a month of him talking to me, he's like, "Lindsay, I can't talk to you about this anymore. Like, you either want help or you don't." And I was like, "But there's got to be some other way than AA." And he was like, "There probably is. There's probably a lot of other ways." He said, "But what is guaranteed to work?" He's like, it says, right, you know, like, and how it works. Like, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And so... He gave me a challenge. He said, "Stay sober for 7 days. See how it goes." And I was like, "All right, I'm going to do this," you know. And he said, "After 7 days, if you don't have any problems with this, I won't talk to you about AA ever again." And so I tried, and I stayed sober for what I thought. I stayed sober for about 4 days. And what happened was that at that point I was back on medication. I'd gone to my doctor and told him that I was depressed and I needed antidepressants. So I was back on medication for that. I was trying to get myself medicated for ADD, and this doctor wouldn't buy it. He was just not interested. He was like, "You don't have ADD." And I was like, no, really, I need this. But I had a drawer full of stuff that doctors had prescribed me over the years, and I started taking it willy-nilly, like, "Well, this will work, maybe this will help today." You know, different things like muscle relaxers, sleeping pills, anything to make me feel different than how I was feeling. And I was not having a moment of sobriety at any point, at any time. So I was really trying. So I don't know what I was not or what I was taking. I know I stopped smoking pot. That was, like, clear. So I did that for 4 days, and then I got really pissed off at work. And I went out with some friends, and I got loaded. And I went home that night, and I felt like I'd gone to the bar, and I just remember feeling so relieved, just like, oh, okay. It's okay. Like, everything's going to be okay. And the only problem was that when I woke up the next morning, I, like, felt the hangover for the first time in years. And it was, the thing was, is I had gotten myself off of so much stuff that all of a sudden I was starting to feel things again. And I saw Ben at work the next day, and he wouldn't talk to me. He knew I had relapsed. I mean, he knew that I wasn't sober. So he knew that I had gotten loaded the night before. And I was like, Ben, and he wouldn't talk. He left. He came, grabbed the laundry, and walked out the door. And he came back later that day, actually, and he said, are you okay? And I said, no, I'm not okay. You know, I need help. Like, I can't do this. And he said, all right. And I said, but I'm going to try a seven-day thing again. So he left. You know, he was like, well, all right, she's not done. You know, so I tried this. And the first time he asked me to do this, I know it was like 2 weeks before school was starting. And I remember he told, and I was like, I can't do this. School starts in 2 weeks. You know, this is the last party time I've got. And he was like, is it your birthday? You know, and I had no reason for, you know, he's like, you have no reason to do this. You have to try it. So, so as far as I know, I tried to stay sober for 7 days, but I was journaling at the time. And school had started, so definitely 2 weeks, more than 2 weeks had gone by. And my original sobriety date was September 16th. And anyway, so I had tried to stay sober, but what happened was I started to drink wine. And I was not a big wine drinker. I liked Long Island iced teas, you know, like anything to get me going. Give me a couple shots and apple teenies, Long Island iced tea. I mean, I wanted the serious all-alcohol drinks. But I started drinking wine because I was like, this doesn't count. It's just wine, you know. But I was drinking, like, a bottle of wine. So, finally, Ben saw me after one night of not being able to do this. And I had gone home, and one of my big things was that I am not a blackout drinker. And because my dad is a blackout drinker, and I, as long as I'm not a blackout drinker, I am okay. And I got home, and my roommate brought in a set of pictures, and she's like, these are great, Lindsay. We had so much fun this night. And I'm looking at these pictures, and all of a sudden I'm starting to see things that I don't know what I don't remember. And I'm standing next to guys, and I'm like, who's this? And she's like, that's the guy you talked to all night long. And I'm like, I don't. And what happened, it turned out that I was going out and blacking out and then coming to as I come home. And, like, I would come out of my blackout, get into bed, because I always remembered getting into bed. And I mean, this is like my higher power being like, here you go. Like, here's your one. It was my one line. I was like, I still have not blacked out. And so I see Ben that next day, and I had been drinking, and he was like, are you done? I mean, what is this going to take? And I was like, no, I'm done. I'm ready. And so he was supposed to lead a meeting that night. And so I went because I wanted to hear Ben speak. And I sat in the room, and I cried and cried and cried. And I mean, just like tears streaming down my face, because all of a sudden I was sitting amongst a group of people that I felt like was home. And I really felt like, you guys, like, you were saying things that I've been thinking my whole life but could never express and could never tell anybody without anybody. I mean, you just, I felt like you were all reading my mind. And I'm like, what is going on here? And, but they had made a mistake because they had double booked. And Ben didn't speak that night. So I held on for a week. I did not go to a meeting for an entire week after that. And waited until the next week when Ben was going to speak. And so I went back and went to that. And I did this, like, I went to one meeting for 3 weeks, you know, like one meeting a week for a couple of weeks. And Ben was telling me, like, you have to get a sponsor. It should be a woman, someone with over 5 years, someone who's worked the steps. And I was like, I don't know, you know. So I asked this one woman to sponsor me, and she never, you know, I called her. She never called me back. So And I met this girl, Kristen, and she and I, she came and led that meeting. And Ben, meanwhile, was like, Lindsay, you can go to other meetings. There are other meetings around. And I was like, I don't, and I was terrified. I mean, suddenly you've taken out my solution to life, like all the drugs, all the alcohol, everything that has gotten me through my days, and you want me to, like, go out in the world? Like, I was like, you're crazy. And I was shaking like a leaf. I mean, just all the time, just shaking everywhere. And Ben was like, what happened? I just thought I was nervous. Now, I mean, now people talk about, like, DTs and, like, detoxing and, like, shaking. I mean, probably that's what was going on. I had no idea. I just knew, like, this is what I did, literally. And I was working in a coffee shop, like, trying to pull shots. I mean, it was just ridiculous. And I was really grateful that I was, you know, like, an assistant, you know, on my track to an assistant manager so I could sit in the back and count money so, like, people wouldn't see me because I was just sweating and awful. But I started working with this girl, Kristen, and we worked together. And the thing was, she said, you know, go to 5 meetings a week, and I would go to 3 or 4. And we would meet every Saturday and sit down and read the big book. And, you know, and slowly, like, things started to get better. And when I had about 8 months sober, my mom told me she was about to have surgery on her. She was going to have surgery on her back in a couple of months. And she needed to have a spinal fusion. And we had gone to war again. I don't know. I had all these crazy ideas. Like, we'd gone to war again, and they were talking about blowing up D.C., and I was like, well, my family's there. I better be there, because if they're going, I'm going with them. And so anyway, I moved across the country, and Kristen was a little concerned, and rightly so. She knew my story. She'd heard my fist up, and she'd heard me tell my geographics, but she sat me down and she said, you have to write about this. I want you to really think about what you're doing, you know, because in Sacramento they are big on, like, no dating your first year, no big decisions, and just sit down and listen, and stay, and maybe you'll make, you know, and like, but so I did a lot of writing, and I rationalized it one more time, and I moved across the country. And this is not to say that people can't move and do all these things. Just for me, this is what, you know, I was running one more time. But I didn't even know it to myself. Like, I moved home. I started school and I didn't know how to do school sober. I mean, I probably didn't know how to do school at all, but I really didn't know how to be sober and go to class. And I enrolled myself in a 12-week intensive anatomy and physiology class for nursing students. And it's not an easy class. It's probably the hardest class I've ever done, regardless of sobriety or not. But so anyway, I don't know how to do this, so I stopped going to meetings because I'm like, this is crazy. This is a lot of work. How am I going to go to meetings and take this class? And I asked one woman to sponsor me, and she said, you know, I'm really good for emergencies. You need to find these meetings. And there are a lot of young people at these meetings. And she circled a bunch of meetings. And but most of them were in D.C. and Maryland. And I'm thinking, why am I going to travel across the state to go to a meeting? Like, that doesn't make sense to me. So, because in Sacramento, they're all the meetings that I went to. I mean, I traveled, but it was like 10 minutes here, 20 minutes there. Having no idea, I mean, I didn't know that, like, the Maryland border was, you know, 5 miles away. I just didn't know. I wasn't from the area. So, like, you know, I'd be like, that's crazy. So, anyway, after 5 weeks, I ended up in a bar, and I was with my brother, David, and when I was in Sacramento, Kristen had said she doesn't go to bars. She doesn't spend time in places where people drink. It's not a good place for her. But she said, you need to learn that on your own. And because I had no idea how defiant it was. Like, if she had said, don't do this, I would have been doing it anyway. And so I did it anyway. But I was really fortunate because I had some friends. If I said it was time to go, it was time to go. And I found I didn't like it, so I stopped going. So I'm thinking, 5 weeks after not going to a meeting, like, I'm okay. I'm going to hear these people play some music, and anyway, my brother, and I told my brother, like, we gotta go. When I tell you we gotta go, it's time to go, and I told my brother it's time to go, and he said, I'm not ready, and he said, I want another drink, and I said, no, I gotta go, and he said, no, I'm not leaving, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna leave you here, and he's like, all right, I'll leave with you if you smoke pot with me, and I was like, huh, okay, so I agreed to that, and then I get in the car, and I had a 20-minute drive, and I'm thinking, call somebody. You don't want to do this. This isn't right. You're 9 months sober. And it was just insane. I mean, my brain was so lost. And anyway, I get home, and my brother's like, it's okay, we're home now. You don't have to smoke pot. It's no big deal. And I was already done because I had already made the decision. I was like, nope, this is what I'm going to do. And it didn't fix me. And I was so miserable, and like I had 3 seconds of being high, and I spent the rest of the evening staring at the refrigerator, knowing there was alcohol in there, and being like, I want to drink. And the only reason I didn't drink was because I would never get back. Like, I knew, I didn't know what would happen if I drank. The next day, I ended up in a young people's AA meeting, and that's where I met my sponsor there, and I was really, really grateful. And people say, like, you have to have 100% of the first step, and that's the thing, is I didn't have 100%. I knew that my life was unmanageable, but for those first 9 months, I didn't believe I was powerless. I didn't believe that, like, if you put something in front of me, you know, I just didn't believe that, like, that I was powerless over my own actions. I thought I had control. And that is something that I still fight with today. You know, like, I think I'm in control. And it's like, you know, God loves to play fun things on me because it's like, no, you're not in control. You know, I'm getting tested with this all the time. But that gave me a real first step. And I started working with a sponsor and going through the steps again. But I did not, I didn't get honest about the fact that I had smoked pot for about 2.5 months because my false pride is so big. And I'm thinking, I didn't drink. I'm okay. I'm still sober. I'm still here. Meanwhile, all these people know that I am crazy. You know, I'm like, yeah, I've been to a meeting in 5 weeks and whatever. And they're like, okay. And what happened for me is I was about to celebrate my year, and I couldn't celebrate it. My conscience and God started working with me and was like, no, you know, and I was getting more and more panicked. And I eventually told someone, like, by the way, you know, 2.5 months ago I smoked pot, and the guy looked at me and he's like, good, you're still here. Glad you told me. Call your sponsor. You know, like, so I called her and we sat down and had tea, and she's like, this is great. Now we can start working a program. You know, now we can get working. And I've done a fourth and fifth step with her. And, you know, the first time I did a fourth and fifth step, I did it thoroughly with my first sponsor, Kristen. But I was really looking to be a victim. I wanted to tell you, like, my story of woe and tell you where my life had gone wrong, and so you would feel sorry for me. And she was like, wow, it sounds like you've had a tough life. But what it really did is it built a relationship with her. And so the next time I called her and was like, I'm having problems with this and this, she said, oh, it sounds like this and this. And I remember being floored. Like, what do you mean? So, I mean, people see things so much clearer than I do. I can't see how things, you know, how relationships pan out in my life. But by her hearing my fifth step, she knew. She was like, oh, isn't that interesting? Sounds like you're in a relationship with your brother and, you know, all this fun stuff. But when I went to do my fourth and fifth step the second time with my current sponsor, I suddenly started to see my part a little bit more clearly. And I definitely didn't see the patterns. A lot of people say they see patterns when they do their fifth step, and I didn't see it. I mean, it's taken me... you know, like 3.5, when I turned 3, I got my 3 years, I suddenly realized, like, wow, I'm sick. Like, really, you know, like, oh, it's not all better, you know, like, I'm still here, I'm still sick, and yeah, but I was really grateful for that, you know, like, when my false pride was so big that when I first got sober, I was looking to do the 12 steps and graduate, you know, I wanted to get those 12 steps out of the way, be a good student, and, you know, and I've done an 8th and 9th step, and I'm in the middle of my 9th step, and I certainly need to be moving on that more. You know, my first 9th step amends was with my grandmother, and she was helping me go to college the first time, and when I withdrew in the second semester, I kept the check for tuition. And so I didn't realize it at the time, but I was practically fighting my sponsor. She was like, you need to go make this amends. And I was like, no, this is going to cause further damage with my dad. This is going to be a problem. And it says right here, we're not here to cause damage. And she just laughed. She was like, you're going. And I did. And I went. And I made amends with her. And, you know, it was pretty, I was terrified. You know, I'm telling this 91-year-old woman that I'm an alcoholic and that I'm an AA. And that I stole $5,000 from her. And, but the reality was, is, you know, like, I have to clean my side of the street. Because if I don't, you know, I can't stay here. And if I don't clean my side of the street, like, I have nothing to give back to the alcoholic who needs help. And, so anyway, like I said, I'm in the middle of my 9th step, and I have a lot to do. You know, I've made amends with my nearest and dearest family, but some of those friends and the personal relationships that sort of dig deep in the gut of my stomach, it's like, those are the ones I'm balking on a little bit. And I'm grateful to be here and to talk to all of you because it reminds me, like, okay, this is where we got to get moving. And, you know, my life today is unbelievable. I mean, I can't see, like, from where I was to where I am today. It's amazing. You know, I've been in and out of college for many years. It's been about 10. And in May, I'm going to graduate. And, you know, I'm getting my bachelor's in health science and management. And then I'm actually hoping to pursue a grad degree in speech language pathology, which, you know, like 8 years or 9 years ago was what I thought I might want to do, you know. And I don't know. I still question it all the time, but we'll see. But, and then I'm getting married. And in July, and that's, like, crazy, but, because when I got into AA, I was writing men off altogether. I mean, really, like, that whole idea of being a lesbian was my big fear on my fist up. Like, maybe I just should go for girls, because I'm so afraid of these men, this is just not happening, and I don't know. And, you know, and then after I had about a year sober, I started dating someone who, after our first date, I was like, no, we're not dating again. And my sponsor rarely gives these, like, distinct, clear, yes, you will do this, and she was like, if you're lucky enough, and he asks you to go out again, you will say yes, and she's known him for years, and, well, I had a judgment against, you know, he mentioned something about money, and I have this thing about money with my dad, and I was like, it's over, you know, and I'm wrong, all the time, wrong, but anyway, so he's amazing, and he's an AA, and he's got 11 years sober, and you actually will hear him in a few weeks, but, you know, and I, you know, and I try and stay busy in AA and try and stay in the middle, and I have, I think, like 4 or 5 service positions, and, you know, but the thing is like, recently, I've kind of made this all about me, because I have a lot of good things happening to me, you know, I'm like, oh, my internship, and my grad school, and my graduation, and my wedding, and it makes me want to throw up right now, because this is not what this is about. This is about giving it away, and, like, my primary purpose is to help another alcoholic achieve sobriety, and I kind of backed away from that a little bit, and I had a wake-up call last week, and so I've been trying to get more in the middle, and it's funny, Rachel was talking, she's like, you do this, she's like, you're either at 0 or you're at 90, and like, and it's true, because that's what I need, you know, I need to be moving so that I can give this away, and anyway, I think I'm about done. But I'm really grateful to be here, and thanks for all of you for listening. And if you're new to AA, like, this program works. It absolutely works, whether I'm working it or not. Like, I've seen it work for people who, I mean, who just figured, like, forget it, life is over. And, I mean, I've watched people, the most amazing thing that I've ever seen in AA is watching the light come on in someone's eyes. And you know, we see people all the time who come in half dead, and there's no life in them. And that's how I was when I got here, you know, like, this was like the last stop on the block. I was like, well, if this doesn't work, I'm just going to kill myself, you know, and all of the stories are different, you know, like, we all have different bottoms and different places, but the thing is like, I can relate, you know, whether I've done the things you've done, I still can relate to the way you feel. And so if you're new, please stay, and please, the one thing that I heard over and over and over again that helped me to hold on to my seat was, like, don't give up 5 seconds before the miracle. So, thanks for letting me share.